This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I've got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way. And that's what I thought when I came downstairs this morning and looked out the window. It's a great song, and I hope that you agree with me. It looks like that's the right weather report. That's a good introduction to our next segment, which is a new feature by one of our summer interns, Saquon Gatlin. It's called Points to Ponder.
Is having a smartphone a smart decision? Welcome to Points to Ponder. Smartphones seem to be essential in the 21st century. One can argue a cell phone indirectly provides both basic and physical needs for Maslow's hierarchy. How so? A phone can access the police for your safety or contact family and friends, giving you a sense of love and belonging from a distance. Their relevance is not in question. The impact of smartphone usage on our health is. Is having access to nearly anything at any time a problem? That depends on if you view instant feedback and gratification as healthy or not. Consider this. You make a costly mistake at work. You get home and decide to watch funny cat videos and more on YouTube to clear your mind. Or a teenage girl may question her self-esteem. She posts a provocative picture on Facebook and receives countless likes. Or a college student wants a better sex life. He finds watching porn simpler than introducing himself to women. The scenarios are endless. Each are an example of micro rewards or quick actions temporarily solving an issue. Feeling sad? Scroll on Twitter and consume entertainment to lift your spirits. Lacking confidence? Look at who liked your photo and your friends' reactions. Micro rewards and instant feedback can be dangerous. Get this. Your brain can release dopamine simply by posting a picture to Snapchat or Facebook because you expect a reaction. If you get the reaction you expected, you feel better by receiving a high. Post more, snap more, tweet more, feel better. There's potential for addiction by receiving a boost of morale, a decline, and repeating the process. However, what happens if you don't receive the feedback you expected? One can feel a deep disappointment, unrest, or even sadness from thinking about the situation. Then what? We are more inclined to jump down the scrolling rabbit hole to Neverland. Statista reported nearly 50% of smartphone users spent more than 5 hours a day on their cell phone in 2017. 5 or more hours. We spend more time staring at a screen than we give each other proper eye contact during a simple conversation or a morning meeting. We spend more time holding aluminum alloys and touching a glass screen than we do holding our loved one's hands or touching a plant or an animal. In a world where connection with anyone at any time has never been simpler, we are more disconnected from our Mother Earth and all of her children, especially each other. One way to combat instant gratification and disconnection is downgrading to a dumb phone. Dumb phones are designed to serve two simple purposes, calling and texting. Many have other functions. However, the design is not to keep you glued to your phone. I recently bought a flip phone with only a handful of functions. My goal is to compare and contrast the pros and cons of downgrading as opposed to keeping a smartphone. In my first week, I've noticed a major pro and a major con of a dumb phone. The good news is my mind has experienced a detox from hyperinformation accessible at any time. The bad news is a smartphone has plenty of conveniency, like GPS. Basically, it boils down to personal preference. What is the price of conveniency? Maybe downgrading is too inconvenient for you or your family. A fun activity you and your friends or coworkers can play is Phone Stack. Phone Stack is a game where everyone stacks their phones on top of each other. No one can use their phone while you are together. Everyone agrees on the reward of winning and the consequence of losing the game. For example, a family may attend a play or concert if no one is on their phone. On the contrary, if anyone uses their phone, no one can go to the event. The first time you play, leave your phones on vibrate. Take note of the background noise. Ask everyone how the buzzing and beeping makes them feel. Was he or she inclined to grab their phone? Did the vibrations annoy anyone? Phone Stack is for reconnecting with your surroundings and focusing on what is at hand, be it at work or family dinner. What do you think about smartphones? Is using one a smart decision? Or are dumb phones wiser? This has been Points to Ponder with Saquon Gatlin. What's your perspective?
Thank you, Quan, for that thought-provoking reverie. A good introduction to the interview brought to us by another summer intern, Colin Berzick. If you have just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I am Susan Franzen, your host for today. Every summer for the past 16 years, the City of Ames hosts a free summer concert series at the Roosevelt. Here's Colin's interview with James Bean, one of the local artists who will be performing live on July 22nd.
Big yellow light. You're just trying to reach your final destination, but there is no end in sight. It's for stop is to go, it's for air is to flow. Though you may feel like you might drown. Oh, I'm here to tell you.
This summer marks the 16th annual Roosevelt Summer Concerts right here in Ames. Starting June 3rd through August 19th, a variety of local and regional bands will be playing at the Annex at 7 p.m. every Sunday night. We're talking all sorts of different music. Blues, jazz, indie, folk, even Latin. One of those artists was nice enough to stop in and grace us with his presence today, James Bean. James, how's it going today,
hey,
man?
I'm good, man. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for stopping in. So we'll just jump right into it, just to let the audience, the listeners know, I guess a little bit of who James Bean is. Where are you from, James?
I grew up in the Des Moines area, Norwalk primarily, just a little bit south of the Des Moines airport there. Went to high school there, graduated from there, went to college in Creston at Southwestern Community College for about 3 years. Then ever since then, I've been a Des Moines resident, so roughly 20 years now.
All right, so you're familiar with the area mostly.
Yeah, absolutely.
How long have you been playing music for?
Oh, started on trumpet at the age of 10, so I mean, if you include my school band days, about that long, so it'd be about 31 years.
31 years.
Yeah. Picked up guitar around the age of 12. You know, I saw a guitarist and a drummer, they're about a year older than me, in junior high, and they did a talent show where they was just those two playing, and it just blew me away, and I'd never seen music being played like that in front of me before. And it was kind of one of those things where I said, oh, well, I gotta be a part of this. And so that following summer, like a couple months later, started guitar lessons, and the rest is history.
So that was really an influential, I guess, moment in your life to start playing music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've talked about it many times, and it's just a pivotal thing where I just kind of, for the first time, really felt driven to do something.
How would you describe your musical sound?
Very guitar based. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of guitar. I'm a big lover of all music, in particular the great American art forms of the last 100 years. So some more than others, but it generally revolves around blues, a little bit of country. A big fan of the 60s and the artists that came out at that time, and then the artists that were influenced by them. compare us to anybody, you know, I'd put us in the, oh, Allman Brothers, Tom Petty kind of thing, you know, very guitars up front, hopefully some melodies. To me, it's a very American sound.
Would you say your musical influences are?
Kind of, it all starts with B.B. King. Even before I started playing guitar, my friends and I were all into the band Aerosmith, and that was something that we were all obsessed with. And then I started playing guitar, and B.B. King was huge. My grandmother got me a book of his songs at the time, and also he had done a cameo on The Cosby Show. And then I started reading interviews with all of these guitar players that I loved, who, like Eric Clapton and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Jimmy Page. Kind of everybody pointed to him as the father figure of,
the one, yeah,
of that style.
Do you have any other band names in mind before you settled on James Bean?
My name?
Yeah, right.
Well, I've been in bands throughout the years. Mm-hmm. I had a band in the late 90s called the McKenzies, and we would play here often. We played the M Shop a handful of times. I'd love to go back and play there. I think fondly about that place.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the McKenzies. Then I did two or three other bands, and I kind of noticed that I was developing, the risk of sounding arrogant, developing a bit of a following where, you know, people were asking me where I was playing. And so eventually I decided 4 or 5 years ago that I was just going to do my name as the band name.
So how did you come to meet the other members that are currently in your band?
Jeff had been playing with a couple other people that I know when I went out to see my friend Jeremy Alvarez, who's great. He has a band called Three-Legged Dog in Des Moines, is my best friend. And Jeff was playing with him. And so after a few times, I just felt like, you know, oh, hey, why don't you come and play a show and we'll just kind of see how it goes. And he's a fantastic player, but even more so, just great guy to be around. And as I get older, I find that, you know, I love all the musicians I play with are great. At this point, I'd almost rather have just somebody that I, you know, it's that hypothetical situation of like, if I had to live with this person in a van for 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
would we all make it?
That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
And in some ways, I mean, that's a good foundation more so than musical ability sometimes. Although, like I said, they're stellar players. And then Chris Fordyce, our bassist, I had lost contact with him. Last time I saw him was maybe around 2002, and he was roommates with a former bandmate of mine, the sax player named Nathan Peoples, and hadn't seen him for a number of years, and then, believe it or not, our wives became Facebook friends and started developing a friendship there, mm-hmm. and then we reconnected after 14 sure. years, yeah. So yeah, that's how we got those two. Saren Evans sings lead and backup with us at times. We've more and more over the last couple of years have started to put more her songs where she sings lead. She's a fantastic singer. And then Seth Hedquist is my other brother on guitar. He and I have developed a really deep relationship.
So as far as the music process, I guess music making process goes, do you write all of your songs? Do you write all the lyrics to your songs?
Well, as far as original material goes, when we go out and play, it's kind of 50-50 because there are some songs that I didn't write that I love playing.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And the band makes them sound good. And I always go back to the idea of, you know, well, when you look at it, a symphony is a cover band.
Right.
And, most jazz groups, combos or otherwise, are cover bands. But as far as my own music goes, I really wanted that to be, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, I wanted that to be the challenge, just to see if I could do it.
So out of all the songs that you've personally written, which one would you say is your favorite and why?
They all mean something just a little bit different to me each time. I don't know. There's one that I wrote called Mission where I try not to get too much into like specifics as to why I wrote it or what it means to me, because I also try to write lyrics in such a way that, you know, like if you listen to one of my songs, you have your own life experiences.
So you're leaving it open to interpretation.
Yeah, and that's what I try to do, because I do feel like if I'm not connecting with people as a musician, then I don't want it. So Mission is kind of one of those songs where, you know, as I get older and as I experience more, I feel like I'm headed in the right way insofar as just becoming a better person and growing as a person. But then I just have the occasional hiccup where I feel like a little bit of one step forward, two steps back kind of thing. But I think as humans, we owe it to ourselves and the people around us to keep trying.
How would you say your music has evolved from when you first joined a band?
Oh, when I first joined a band, I mean, first off, I never wrote lyrics. I was in a band with a singer who, A, wrote incredible lyrics, B, was and is an incredible vocalist, and C, took a look at some lyrics that I wrote one summer and said, no, these aren't good. and that was enough for me to kind of stay off that path for a while, where I just focused on the instrumental side so much that I was in a band at one point where we did primarily instrumental songs. So early on, it was very guitar oriented, also very in your face, you know, a little bit of dynamics, but it's still pretty rock in your face.
Right. Kinda.
That band was influenced by a lot of 90s groups, in particular the Black Crowes.
Okay.
We're still one of my favorite bands, but you know, that bands like that have a lot of...
We're referring to the McKenzies, right?
Is that... Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
McKenzies, have a lot of bands like that. I mean, there's a lot of guitar. So even the subtle moments are still like, not subtle. So then it was much more guitar-oriented. I didn't worry about the lyrics or the vocals. Also, to a degree, didn't feel like anybody wanted to hear what I had to say as a vocalist or as a lyricist. As time has gone on, I've grown more confident in those abilities.
So earlier, you said that you really enjoyed playing at the Maintenance Shop. And I see also that you have shows, you do shows in Ankeny, you do shows in Des Moines. Where would you say your favorite venue is to play at and why?
You know, anymore, my favorite venues are, they tend to be the ones where you least expect them to be good. For about 4 years now, my band and I have been playing at the Greenwood Lounge in Des Moines, which is, it's on Ingersoll. There are a lot of great music venues along the Ingersoll Avenue area in Des Moines. It's not a place, like when you walk in, you wouldn't expect it to feel as good as it does.
So it's kind of deceiving.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of part, I describe it as part church, part dive bar. You know, there's the bar and there's the corner TV playing the Cubs game. You know, it's just there. It's nothing too fancy. It's dark a lot.
Pretty low-key place, you know? You'd say.
Yeah. But man, from the first gig we played there, I had one of the best musical experiences I've ever had during our first or second gig there, where I just felt like, you know, maybe it doesn't matter like where you play. I don't know. They're just, some places just have magic to them.
I saw on your Facebook page that you post tutorials on how to play guitar on certain songs. I saw covers of Guns N' Roses. So are you a teacher? Do you teach guitar?
Yeah. I mean, that's, in a way, that's my day job. I own and operate a music lesson studio in Des Moines called Central Iowa Music Lab. And we have a little over 200 students, about 225 is where we run. And we teach guitar, piano, drums, voice, the band instruments now we teach, which I would rather that be left up to the public schools, but you know, with each year comes more arts, you know, funding gets cut, and so parents start looking for places to do, for their kids to do lessons for band, and you know, until that problem gets fixed, we try to help them out.
For some of the young listeners that might be tuning in on this interview, what advice would you give them to start their own band?
Find your friends. You know, make your friends learn instruments. Go that way. You know, I find if the personalities are there already, and you know, sometimes things change, but for the most part, if you find the personalities and the people that you get along with, and I guess to a degree, part of that includes a certain amount of work ethic. You know, someone told me a while back, do one thing a day to propel yourself forward as far as should you want to do music professionally.
This is kind of similar to the question I asked earlier. Is there a particular song that you enjoy playing live in front of an audience?
I mean, it's funny because it's different every time, I think. I write a song with the intention that every time I sing it, it's going to be great. It's going to feel great to me. I'm going to be excited about it. I'm going to, you know, I want it to be something I can sing for 30 years and be all right. But sometimes the crowd reaction, sometimes there'll be one song where they'll love it, and then the next gig, it'll be a different song. The fan reaction will be, or the listener reaction will be different. So, I mean, there are tunes, like I said, maybe some night I'm just feeling like, you know, Mission is the song I'm really looking forward to playing. It's really not until that back and forth dynamic between band and audience. When that's strongest, I won't know if that's my favorite song until after we've played it. I hope that makes sense.
Right, right. All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping in and letting me interview you today.
Yeah.
Again, it's James Bean. He will be performing on the 22nd of July at 7 p.m. That's at the Annex at the Roosevelt Summer Concerts, right here in Ames. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever had the notion to life is so
just one great big tug of war. No, no. You're just pushing Bob Moran and Doug. You have to wonder what the hell it's for. It's not the why or the how, but the here and the now. It'll creep upon you without a sound. Oh, I'm here to help you through this basic existence.
Colin's interview was intended to introduce people to the music series at the former Roosevelt School. That was an event that grew out of the struggle of the Roosevelt neighbors to keep that community space available. Our next segment is about a controversy that affected the Northridge neighborhood. According to state law, any owner of a cemetery must maintain that space and not disturb the graves. In most cases, the owners are farmers who have discover a pioneer cemetery in the middle of their fields. But this is a more unusual situation, and Dave Gradwall is here to tell us the story.
In 1991, there was a survey done on land that developers here were undertaking to build a house for a man in town right here in Ames up at Northridge. The burial mound was discovered. Archaeologists found it from Iowa State University Archaeological Laboratory. There was a mound, and we knew of a very large camp or habitation site that was in an adjacent field, and we found an indication that there was a habitation site. And then the question is it a glacial mound naturally occurring, or is it something that humans built? And you can test that by putting down a soil probe. And this was not a natural soil development. Additional soil probes were put in, and one of them brought up an identifiable piece of human bone.
It's a burial site.
Yes. The state archaeologist, according to the Iowa Burial Code, ruled that there could not be any disturbance of the mound. And there was some irritation on the developer's part, and I understand it, from their economic corporate point of view. But I noticed that none of the developers here in town are putting houses down on their family grave sites in the Ames Municipal Cemetery, which I would argue is sacred to our culture. The developers had suggested that we, quote, move the mound down to Moore Park. Well, you can't move a mound like you move a building. The realtor said to the state archaeologist and to the state, if we can't build, then you need to pay us for that house lot, which was, I don't know, $40,000 or $50,000. I don't know exactly, but it was pretty pricey. So this went up to the higher courts, which held that that was a pre-existing covenant, that they had to preserve the mound according to our laws. And that was just one of the risks that you take over when you buy a piece of land. Certainly, if archaeologists here in Iowa and across the country had to pay back for every site that couldn't be built on, it would bankrupt them. It was really a landmark case, and we were all watching it. And it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
This piece of land here in Ames.
Yes. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they upheld essentially the lower court in not taking it on their docket. And the decision that was made in that case, as far as I know, is that three adjoining landowners to that particular piece of property bought parcels of the land as part of their yards, but they're not allowed to build on it, on top of the mound.
So the site today is not publicly accessible?
No.
So the yard still remains as a private piece of property, but it can't be changed in
that
any way?
That is right. It can't be built on legally.
It's almost like a historic landmark status.
I thought it was, and it would have been my preference, personally, to have the site as a historic site that people could go to, ask them not to walk on top of the mound, but to explain to them, you know, what this mound was and what its significance was.
As somebody who has spent a great deal of time dealing with sacred sites in your profession, what do you think the benefit to us as human beings, as land is developed on this continent, that we build it in a way so that these sites are integrated and protected and not destroyed. What is the human benefit to that?
All of these people are, and even ourselves, we're interesting. You know, we should know more about ourselves and about other people. I think we need to understand other cultures, and I think we need to understand ourselves. We need to understand the degree to which we are products of the past. Your ancestors and mine came from Europe. We need to understand that heritage. By the same token, those of us whose people came from other places ought to respect the indigenous people here. And having kinds of historic sites and sacred sites and destinations, they can fit in to economic plans for tourism and so forth. I would like to think that human beings would respect each other. Diversity is increasing. We, particularly in the United States, claiming to be a democracy and a land of freedom, people of different races, people of different religions, people of different national origins, would learn to live together, and that we would celebrate that diversity.
David Gradwall, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology and Founding Director of the ISU Archaeological Lab.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Ursula, for that interview. Here in the studio with us, we have Carolyn Myers and Ann Kinsel from the Ames Progressive Alliance with a couple of very distinguished guests. So, Ann, would you please introduce our guests?
Yes, we have Alyssa Franson this morning and Luke Dierdorf, respectively president and I think, what is it?
Vice president.
Vice president of the Ames Community School District. For our listeners, I'd like to give a brief recap. We're going to be talking about progress towards the new Ames High School today. On April 3rd of this year, Ames voters approved a $110 million bond referendum for new school construction. About $95 million will go towards the construction of a new high school, with the rest being used to expand Edwards, Meeker, and Mitchell Elementaries. The referendum passed with 84.77%, of the voters in favor of the bond. 5,502 voters in Ames participated. That's a little bit disappointing for a turnout of approximately 13.8%, but I understand pretty typical for these kind of races. One of the goals of the Ames Progressive Alliance is to get more people involved in the local governing process. That's why we have this show, to give folks one more source of community news. So welcome this morning to Alyssa and Luke. Thanks for coming so early.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. We're really pleased to have you both here today to provide the community with an update on the progress being made. So, Alyssa, I'll start with you. It's our understanding that the district is currently in a programming phase.
That's right.
We know that's some kind of bureaucratic speak for something. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So I would say the programming is the idea generation phase. And the architects, they began their work by meeting with the school board, and then they met with different groups of teachers from the high school, administration, different programs from fine arts and athletics, students. And a part of this, the part of the programming phase they're doing is really to identify what is it we all believe should be in our high school, what should not be in our high school, and what do we want that experience to be like for this facility. So there will also be a community, because we are in the middle of it, we're not done, and the community will also have an opportunity in a couple of weeks.
Sounds like you have a lot of focus on stakeholder groups.
Absolutely.
So these meetings with the community, can you give us an idea where, when, how they will take place?
So the time and date is going to be specifically set, I think, at the early of next week. But it's looking like sometime in the week of June 4th, and there will be more than one and in different locations. So hopefully to provide an opportunity in different area of Ames to make it convenient, potentially one over the noon hour and one right after the workday to try to capture a different opening in community member schedules.
And how about students who are still in the system? Will there be meetings with them?
Yep. So they've already had some meetings, and they will I believe they just had a meeting this week, an additional meeting. So to continue to provide the students with some opportunities, because as we've talked, I've talked with students who have some really fascinating ideas of what they'd like to see as a part of the new high school, even though they say, well, I know I'm never going to experience it, but I understand the high school experience. So they are interested in sharing their viewpoints.
Excellent. How long will this programming phase last?
So the programming will wrap up in the month of June, and then they will go into the design schematic process from July into, I think, August or September. So programming will officially wrap up, though, in the month of June.
Awesome. So, Carolyn, I think you have some questions for Luke.
Yes. I understand that in early May, a team made up of board members and district administrators and employees toured seven high schools, which is quite a lot. And they were all in Minnesota. So you did like St. Peter High School, Waconia, Chanhassen, Edina, Shakop, Burnsville, and I probably mispronounced some of those, and Farmington as part of the programming phase for the new school plan. That really is a lot of high schools. What did you learn from visiting all these different high schools?
You know, it was interesting to me in the fact that many of these schools are fairly progressive in how they approach education. And we learned that people can operate in different spaces. But what we're most excited about is what that learning landscape looks like. We saw a lot of collaborative spaces, a lot of glass walls, a lot of breakout areas that I think would really provide our students and staff a great way of taking it to the next level as far as the education that we're trying to achieve at our district. So it was good to see how people use different aspects of their community engagement within that building. So trying to partition the building such that whether it's fine arts or academics, we can section off the building to make sure we have security as a important element of that, as well as people coming and going that has a good dynamic for that whole facility.
What do you think, or what did you learn by touring all these high schools, and how will that influence the design of the new high school?
So it's great to see, and Elisa mentioned it, that we had a programming session with our board. But until you actually get in a building and actually see how it's being utilized, I think you can learn a lot. So just the volume of space, the corridor space, making sure those are nice and wide with good circulation. Also sight lines for security. We saw some different ways in which school districts were trying to tackle that issue, and I thought it opened our eyes, both administrators and also Lisa and I, to how we can try to best set this school up going forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll be learning any of these ideas that you've – or I'm sorry, sharing any of these ideas that you learned from these tours with the public during some of your meetings?
Yep, and I think that's going to happen through that community work session. So our architects will be there soliciting feedback, but also sharing kind of what they've learned through the process and talking about best practices. So, again, we're in the beginning stages of this, but we're excited to continue to receive feedback.
That's a lot of high schools. So how come you didn't go to any in Iowa? I'm just curious.
I think part of the reason we didn't do that was because we actually split the focus into administration and us going into some fairly progressive areas in the Twin Cities. We're having staff tour more regional or local here in Iowa. So those tours will be happening here during the summer, I believe, and to get more of a broader perspective.
So which high schools in Iowa do you think you'll be touring?
They haven't been set yet.
Oh, okay.
So I would assume some of the newer ones like Johnston, maybe some over in Iowa City area. Mm-hmm. But, again, we haven't finalized that.
So what criteria are you looking for when you decide what schools the staff will tour?
So our architects are trying to find different ways of saying how do you approach this issue. So you talk about the auditorium. So let's look at different ways in which people are using an auditorium. So let's look at maybe a 800-seat auditorium. Let's look at a 1,200-seat auditorium. So trying to understand the benefits and downfalls of those configurations. Mm-hmm. So trying to be a little bit varied in who we're looking at.
Do you see a lot of use of technology in these schools?
We do. I think a lot of it is making sure it's mobile, making sure that we have outlets and places for students to plug in and get their laptops and things recharged. I think what, as I reflect, I love the way in which it felt more like a campus atmosphere. We visited one school where They had flexible classroom time where they might have 30 kids in a class, but that administrator was saying that they only maybe have 15 in that certain classroom at one given point because other students are throughout the whole building, maximizing breakout spaces and other ways of learning. So I like that flexibleness of that design. So, again, the operational side of things was, I think, helpful, too, when we did that tour.
Yeah, it's often been a criticism of education that it's a follower of fads. Are you concerned that any of the stuff that you see is something, is the flavor of the decade or the, you know, 5 years? How does that figure in?
Well, that's one thing that we have talked about, that we do desire for this facility to transcend the essence of time. And so, you know, you can look at it from in terms of the size that you're building and making sure that it can manage what our community may ebb and flow in terms of our enrollment, but then also those spaces to utilize to make sure that you are not. And there were, you know, there were some things that we saw that as a group, we said, you know, that doesn't seem like that would stand the test of time. So let's make sure that we have some spaces that we can utilize and provide that word flexibility so that we can have different setups for our students and our teachers and staff to be able to utilize that space in a variety of ways.
Someday you'll have to share with us what some of the weird stuff you saw, but we'll leave that for another time. After these site visits are concluded, mm-hmm. what are the next steps in the process? Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a bit?
Sure. So on June 4th, just one step of the process is that the architects will be at our meeting and providing, you asked, well, how can we find this information about some of these tours? So they're going to be providing an update of where they are in the programming process right now, whether it's pictures and some discussion about what we saw in Minnesota to what they are learning with all of their meetings, the programming meetings that with all of the staff. The community input sessions will not have taken place by that point, but then the architects will come back then in July during our July 9th meeting, and that will provide more of the closure for the board of the programming's time that they've done so that they can then move into that design schematic process.
So can you give us a kind of a timeline of when you see the high school from where we are today in the programming phase through to conclusion?
Sure. So we move into the design schematic and then more into a specific design phase in the fall into next winter, when they will start to go out to bid.
Okay, so in the winter of 2019.
Pending on how all of the bidding goes, potentially breaking down in June of 2019.
Okay, when do you think the building will, I don't know, you don't christen a building with a champagne bottle, but yep. like a ship, but when's that going to happen?
So the desire would be in April or May of 2022 to have the building finished so that then we can start, because it's not a matter of you just move everything. Our technology, we have to be able to get everything up and running. So the goal is April 2022 to have that facility finished so that they can move things over, because then, of course, then we have to demolish the current facility.
Sure. One thing that people always say is, when can I see the model? When do you mm-hmm. think you'll get a Have the architects talked about that? Yeah. You know, one of their great little models there where you can see it in 3D? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They'll have that as part of the design element. It may not be – I'm pretty sure it won't be at the June 4th meeting, but probably some of us will see some actual renditions of what this will look like.
So the taxpayers are going to be investing about $195 million in the new school. So what do you anticipate will be the lifespan before the next group of taxpayers is asked to pony
mm-hmm.
up?
Mm-hmm. So it's actually $105 million of the $110. So, you know, I've heard the term thrown out, well, 50 to 60 years. I have no idea because I'm not in the construction business, but I would desire this to last a very, very long time.
From quality talks, right?
And from a taxpayer standpoint, our facilities are in a state to where there should be some stability going forward. So there really should be no need to draw upon taxpayer funds for facilities for the foreseeable future, especially given the fact that the bond included addition money for our elementaries. So I don't foresee that being an issue.
Can
Can you tell us more about the addition for the elementary schools on the bond and why that was necessary? Because I know a lot of taxpayers had questions with that because, you know, we recently redid several of the elementary schools. So tell us more about what you learned and how that ended up being added.
So that was kind of a last-minute decision that I think caused quite a bit of confusion. So looking back, we may have done that differently. However, it made sense financially to put it within the bond referendum because the interest rates are cheaper compared to our sales tax revenue for bonding. So that's why last minute we decided, hey, let's tack this in because we are seeing enrollment growth within the district. So it provides us flexibility. If we don't see this enrollment tick up, we don't have to spend the money. So it just provides us the flexibility to, should our class sizes mandate a need for more space, we can then go into the ground and get additional sections added on.
The indications last fall were that we were up 200 by our count date, so being prepared so that our buildings were built, Edwards and Meeker were both built that we can pretty quick and easy add six additional classrooms to each of those facilities. So that provides us the opportunity to be able to add that space should we need to in a moment of time. We were concerned that if we didn't add it, so then you go back for a bond issue in 2 years. And so, we don't want the public to have this feeling that we're coming back every couple of years. Let's be a little more planful about it.
Yeah, that makes some sense. I understand. I just think that a lot of people really weren't quite understanding, but that makes a lot of sense when you talk about it that way, just to be prepared in case there is a big uptick in elementary school numbers. Can you tell me more about the current elementary schools and why you don't think that they would work if we had more population? Is it just mainly space or is there other issues?
No, it's absolutely – it's just space. And the unique thing about Ames, and in the past, they've hired consultants to come in and try to anticipate what our enrollment is. You can't. It is – we are just so dependent upon what happens with an enrollment at Iowa State. And so it's really difficult to identify where we may be moving. And so the current elementary schools, a case in point at Edwards, so each of the wings has a flex classroom. So maybe there's one flex classroom available in the kindergarten and first grade wing, but all the kindergarten and first grade classrooms are full. Well, if we need to add an additional kindergarten class and an additional first grade class, we don't have room because we have only that one flex space. So really, and looking at some of the construction that's taking place over in West Ames and over by the Edwards neighborhood, and then some also north by Sawyer, it provides us that opportunity to have that flexibility because we are approaching, while you may walk in there and say, we're not completely full, but we are approaching a point that we will be full and we don't want to have too many kids in one classroom. Mm-hmm. So,
well, it is interesting. I mean, if you look at Census Bureau figures, the cohorts of 18-year-olds born after 2001 – is really trending downwards quite dramatically. It's interesting that we don't hear much about that in Ames because we're so dependent on Iowa State University. But it is a concern of mine because, you know, births are births. Mm-hmm. Unless immigration policy changes radically, they're just not going to be that many children. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to both the elementary schools and to the community. Mm-hmm.
The one interesting piece is we've seen a lot of open enrollment as well. So it used to be we'd have 200 kids open roll in, 200 kids open roll out. Within the last 5 years, we've seen that shift from 200 out and 400 in. So we're starting to grab more people from whether it's the Gilbert School District or even outside of that area wanting to come to Ames, and that's we are seeing that kind of growth from that element.
So what do you attribute that to? Besides being great.
Sure.
I know.
You know, it's interesting the fact that when I talk to new families coming or just community members, I say, you know, we have two wonderful school districts between Gilbert and Ames, and they provide a great environment for kids, but they're a little bit different. And I think it allows parents the choice of what do they want. I think traditionally I went to Ames High and had a wonderful experience. I feel like we provide more opportunities because we can have just more staff and more things going on. So, but the flavor is a little bit different. So it's just a good opportunity for parents to decide what are they really looking for their kids.
Going back to the programming and design phase, there's something I'm curious about. How do the teachers participate in this? Mm-hmm. Because obviously they're the ones there every day with the kids.
So within their departmental meetings, they have had discussions about specifics, and some have gotten very specific, which has been great hearing from our architects when the teams come. And so the department teams have gotten together and developed their ideas. And then we have subject area leaders who have met. So maybe it was the science area that they had a select number of the science teachers. Anyone was welcome, but a select number of them to bring those ideas from the department, and they met with the architects for a set period of time to go through what were their hopes and dreams for the new school, what are the things that no, we don't think that we need in, but and to get their gauge their ideas. So they had those initial times. They're also doing another time. I think it's the Monday or Tuesday after school is out when our teachers are still there. Our architects are going to come in and do some additional programming to make sure that we are providing all of our teachers the opportunity to share their feedback and their vision of what this could look like.
Now, this is kind of probably a funny question, but middle schoolers are such an interesting bunch. Mm-hmm. And their teachers are, I'm convinced, the saints among us. Are you asking them any questions about how their thinking come into this? They're the ones who are going to be there.
The middle school students,
yeah,
or the middle school
both.
Teachers?
Oh, actually, both.
Both. There has not been an active process to reach out to them, but of course they would have an opportunity to be a part of those community meetings,
the community
as anyone
discussions.
Would.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Along with that, I'm kind of curious, when you've asked some of the high school students who are currently at Ames High some of the ideas and suggestions they've had, I'm kind of curious what some of them have been. Do you remember any of them?
Well, I haven't met specifically
okay.
with that. I mean, I've had informal
sure,
conversations,
sure.
and they range anywhere from safety, obviously, mm-hmm. is one. We have students who are very much interested in making sure that our building is as conducive as possible with energy use, and so a range of ideas, and also some programmatically in terms of how they would use the space as students in small workspaces and large group workspaces, mm-hmm. and so forth. So,
speaking of energy, will the building have any kind of LEED certification? Will it take advantage of any of the newer technologies?
So the specifically for LEED, we've talked to our architects about that, and we'll try to solicit their feedback on moving that forward. That certification, while it's well and good, it comes at a cost. So trying to balance, okay, how do we make sure we get either more square footage or better amenities versus a certification, I think we need to kind of wrestle with still. There'll be a lot of elements with geothermal energy. We're looking at solar, looking at wind. So trying to tap into various sources of energy is what we hope to accomplish as well.
Would you be doing solar on site, or would you be cooperating with the city as it expands the solar farm concept?
We don't know yet, but it's just those. We want to make sure that our architects are thinking through that and having those discussions.
That would influence operating costs. I know it costs to be in a LEED certified building. Also, it costs money for training of the employees who maintain the building, and those are not insignificant. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, they're potentially interesting maintenance and ongoing costs that are avoided.
Yeah, and the district has a lot more capital to work with than operating budgets. So anything we can do to spend a little bit more on like wind energy and put up a turbine would be probably useful in the fact that we could lower our energy cost. So I'm very interested in learning more about that and seeing what we can do with the Ames new solar system they're looking at doing. So maybe solar won't work. We want to make sure we at least explore it to see what we can possibly do.
That'd be exciting. I think a lot of young people, we see that at Iowa State with the Live Green movement. Mm-hmm. A lot of young people are pushing us, perhaps mm-hmm. beyond our comfort zones, but certainly well-intentioned to get in that area.
Yes, I completely agree. I can really see where this generation of students, that's something that's very important to them. So mm-hmm. I'm so glad in general, the school district, as well as yourselves, are willing to listen to the students and get some of their ideas, because I think that they know the best of what they're missing or what they wish they had versus you know, necessarily their parents, because they're the ones who are in school at the time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm just really glad to hear that you're doing that. So thank you.
A lot of what the students that I'm hearing, too, are saying they want outdoor space.
Oh,
and
sure.
So there's we're trying to figure out a way to how do we provide that in a safe and secure environment. So mm-hmm. it's this constant balance of security versus openness and a nurturing school building. So it's like how do you best provide that because we don't want a prison, but we also don't want to have it wide open to anybody. Mm-hmm. So I'm just really excited to see what we can do with courtyard space and how we can incorporate, you know, possibly the south side of all those trees and trying to incorporate a feel that would be welcoming to mm-hmm. kids being outside.
There's no small irony that when I went to school, and that's been a while ago, we did feel like it was a prison and they didn't want us to leave at the dreaded lunch hour. But now it seems like the dynamic is let's not let anybody in. So it is an interesting balancing act. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What have you seen about that in the design?
In terms of the ins and outs So obviously, in today's day and age, we will have a security system, and there's different ways of doing it, but we will definitely, that is obviously at the forefront of the district and the architect's mind. So in terms of the ins and the outs, you know, we will have fewer doors, and we talked about that at our current facility, that there are a lot of doors. So how do you manage that and put that into the design process where it is a manageable number, but it allows the flow that we need to have in a facility.
This is a naive question, but I'm from California where all schools are one story. Mm-hmm. So will this have more than one story?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work with the doors and fire? I mean, how do to get in and out?
Oh, to get in and out on multiple levels?
Yeah.
Well, I would anticipate like any other multiple level building, so making sure they have access to a stairway or somewhere to exit. So, I mean, it'll follow any code.
Sure, absolutely. It's just the things that we have to think about now that go so far beyond what we thought of. What was it, the ABCs and learning how to count and multiply, right?
Yeah. And you can stretch that to so many things within the school district on the expectations folks have for what we can accomplish during the school day.
So before we close, I have one last question I want to ask you. You're both public servants. And we want to thank you for that. But I want to know, how much time do you give to our community in your respective positions as president and vice president of the school board?
So this spring, it has served as about a full-time job. And that obviously, it's been a unique spring. And so you would not typically put in that amount of time. But I think serving in the – when you're in the president and in the vice president role, you do have more meetings and different opportunities to represent the school district. So there are weeks that you could put in 30 hours. But generally, 20 hours is a pretty accurate count for a week-to-week time commitment.
Well, thank you, and thank you for sharing that with us. And you, Luke, what are you?
It'd be the same.
It'd be the same.
And a lot of it, too, is these side conversations that you have and thinking through how do you best navigate and strategize how we tackle the next issue. So, 20 or 30 hours a week is fairly common.
Well, certainly, we understand. I've always heard that there's politics and then there's school board politics. So we thank you for your work. So we are closing our episode today, our talk. Thank you so much, Alyssa and Luke, for joining us this morning and sharing your experience and helping to build a more progressive Ames community. Everybody, please be sure and keep up with Ames Progressive Alliance activities on our Facebook page and on our website at AmesProgressiveAlliance.org. You can always follow the latest Ames Progressive Alliance developments on the web. Thank you, and have a great Memorial Day weekend, everybody.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and I've been your host for today, Susan Franzen, and thanks to Ames Progressive Alliance for coming in. Other voices you heard were Ann Kinsel, Carolyn Myers, Alyssa Franzen, and Luke Deardorff, as well as Saquon Gatlin, Colin Burzek, James Bean, and David Gradwall. You can listen to today's local talk show and many of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At the top of the hour. Morning Masterpieces will follow at 9 a.m. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The Farmers Market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, a member-based organization that develops business from group tours, leisure travel, and convention and meeting markets. More information at thinkames.com. That's thinkames.com.